Become a podcast buddy now and get exclusive access to the new podcast episodes. You can find more information about this on my website, schulzekopp.de.
Welcome to this podcast.
Water Polo Expert Talk. Get the insights. Yeah, so we continue with the next episode of the Water Polo Expert Talk podcast, and I'm very happy to have one of based on the press, one of the best players and the best scorer in the World Championship last time, Alex. So thanks for joining today, and it's up to you. So so we start with a little personal introduction, maybe.
My name is Alex Bowen. I'm an American water polo player. I've been to the Olympics two times, to Rio and Tokyo. I graduated Stanford in 2015 and have played in now Romania, Hungary, Croatia, Greece, Serbia, and now in France. So I've been able to use water polo to get around the world and really experience different cultures, different styles of water polo, and really try and use that to better myself and better the game, hopefully.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you played also at the moment in France, and mm-hmm. Also before that, in some other European countries. But at the very beginning, so also you mentioned that you played for Stanford and so on. So maybe mm-hmm. you can give us a little bit more insight about the system in the U.S. So because I have already done some talks also with people coming from the U.S. and saying, okay, our system here in the U.S. is totally different than the one in Europe, for example.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of school and mm-hmm. sports, and also the connection between the personal development and school and the sports. So what can you tell us about the system in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. So I'm from San Diego. I grew up, I played for my local high school. And usually the way that works is you have your high school season in the fall from August to November, and then usually December off, and then you're with your club team for the rest of the year up until like the National Junior Olympics right around July, middle of July. So you go January to July with your club team, and that's how it goes like when you're at high school age, so 14 to 18. Before that, you're just with clubs, you're with maybe some feeder programs for your high school, and it's really about there's a big connection between the high school and the sports. It's just it's the way the American system goes and helps with kids to keep them engaged and stuff with the mm-hmm. school. So beyond that, it's high school for the most part, and then club as well. Club kind of is more important. You get to be seen more by college coaches. The level of competition is higher and that kind of stuff. So you really use the club to get into college, and then from college, there's not really anything afterwards. So you make the team, and then you go abroad, and then
So hopefully then the career will go on. Yeah. So
yes.
after that point. Yeah. So I think basically the impression from Europe or from mm-hmm. Germany, seeing what are the efforts also in the US to grow the water polo as a sport, and mm-hmm. also to get as possible kids on board. Mm-hmm. There are so many personal or private projects, let's say that way. Yeah, so to make this happen again, and not only related this to the school, also to the clubs. Yeah, so there are so many projects, at least from my point of view, on the way to make this change there.
Well, like for instance, one of the big things that happened the last couple of years was the introduction of water polo into Texas. Texas has recently approved for high school sports water polo as a division one, like their high school organization has approved water polo. So overnight, like 100 different high schools have now added water polo, which is incredible. I mean, it's huge because 100 programs, 30 kids a program, that's 300 kids right away. And it's even more than that because it's going to continue to grow there, And that's huge because it's also access to, money from the schools. So money from the government, money from schools, and that funding comes in and helps grow the sport as well. So that's absolutely huge for that. And then beyond that, you have a bunch of clubs popping up in Texas. And you have a lot of, there were some there already. And there was like a small pockets of water polo there already, but now that it's statewide and Texas is enormous. So
yeah.
The introduction of it is, 100 high schools is probably a criminally low estimation, but like it's now all of a sudden, all of these schools get it. All of these schools have funding for water polo and like that's one of the biggest things about it. And then,
And how does your personal career started at the very beginning? So how do you come to play water polo? Saying, okay, I would like to play water polo because I saw these guys in the TV at the Olympics, or was it by accident? Or what was your way to water polo?
Oh, my dad was a coach.
In this case, it's short.
No, I mean, I started very young. My dad's a high school coach. He still is a high school coach. He's he just finished a tournament in LA, and now he's sleeping because it's time difference. But so I grew up around the pool. He's been coaching longer than I've been alive. Like coming back from as like a young kid, like I would go to the pool and like do my homework and then jump in the water and swim in the shallow end while the rest of the team was practicing.
Yeah. So maybe in this case, we have really the advantage of your location. Yeah. That you are able to do that, to make your homework coming from school, make homework and then going to the pool.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So especially in the case when you say, okay, your dad is also a water polo coach. Do you think it's for you as a player of your, well, be the son of your dad, totally clear, but it's really a pressure for you saying, okay, I would like to play water polo because your dad is a coach? Or is it something total normal? Because in some cases, it could be some extra pressure on kids saying, okay, I have so close connection to the sport.
Well, I don't think I really felt pressured for my dad to do it. It just felt like something that I was going to do, you know, like I grew up around the pool. Like I have one younger brother. I'm the oldest, for the kids in my the oldest of my siblings. And like growing up around like high school water polo and everything, it always felt like I had a bunch of these older brothers that were all around. And it just felt like I was going into the, like I was joining the team. I was joining these group of guys, and it was, there was never really a pressure to play. It was just like, no, it's time to play. It's like, I'm excited.
let's play.
Yeah. And, it was great playing for my dad. He was I respect my dad, so much because he was able to, he coached me from to like 8 years old. And when I got into high school, it was I joined San Diego Shores, which is a club in San Diego, one of the best. And I got to learn from other coaches from there. And he stepped away. And it's like, okay, well, he was always there to help manage and make sure that like I was getting better and really like making sure that I knew the game as well as I could, but also absorbing the different perspectives of other coaches.
Yeah. And when you say, okay, I need to have or to experience also other perspective from other coaches, are there any advice from your dad at the very beginning you also have today in mind, or where you can say, okay, these are really the basics and these one or two things I captured for the whole time and also today, and I benefit from these one or two things or advices or tips and tricks from your dad at the very beginning?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, like my dad was very, he really pushed me to be able to take something from every coach that I've had. And I everywhere I've been, I always try and take at least one thing from every coach that I've had the pleasure of playing for. And, it's really about the kind of the core, philosophy of being coachable. Like coachability is one of the biggest things in water polo in life, like being able to take criticism, being able to learn and adapt and change different kind of perspectives. So, I mean, that's a lot of the things like that I tell kids, like you have to be coachable. Like you have to listen to the coach, take what they're doing, make sure that you're doing the best you can towards that style, and then implement your own style as well. It's never going to be completely 100% one way, 100% the other way, but there's a mixture, and it's like the truth is in between them. Find that.
Yeah. Coachable is really a new word. I heard it for the first time, but it makes absolutely sense to say, okay, you have to be coachable, and that you are able to say, okay, I would like to use these advice coming from this coach and this coach, and I have to work with all the information and do the best I can. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you say, you have to get all the different differences from all the coaches you played for, what do you say, or what would you say, what makes a good coach for you?
What makes a good coach for me is somebody who's intelligence is huge, but also being able to relate to the players as well, like being able to get the best out of all the players, make them reach their potential. And I mean, coaches have different tactics of how they do that. And it's comes from how their coaches taught them. You know, it's kind of hard to put words to, but it's,
So maybe we have to make a totally new episode on that question. It's really basic, but it's not so easy to answer maybe.
Yeah, but it's the same with all sports. Like that's one of the things that comes from being a coach and being like in that position of how do I get the best out of my players, on top of like I can give them all the information, I can develop them, but then on top of that, how do I get the best out of them? And that's pillars of what a good coach is.
I have also podcast talk with your coach Dejan some weeks ago, and he told me, okay, for his work with the US team, it's really important to have several players playing in Europe. So at least to have these as much as possible players playing on the high level of water polo all the time, and have also then the benefits for the US team then at the end, and to work with best skilled water polo players. And you say also that you already played in several countries, Hungary, Serbia, and so on. So, and now in France, what do you think makes it so important for your coach, but also for every other coach or head coach of a national team, for example, saying, okay, we need to have these players playing in the Champions League or European top leagues. What do you think? Why is this important?
Oh, it's experience. I mean, when you're coming from like the American system, you play, like we have a system within college of the stronger, faster kind of mentality. And I mean, you see that kind of within the year when we play, like we're very fast, we're very strong, we're very fit. But it's also, it's the developing the mental side of the game and being able to see and play at the highest level and being able to adapt. And it's the little things, the change and the little thing, the athleticism to steal from people and that kind of stuff. Like it's playing against professionals and playing against the mentality of I have to beat you to get this bonus so I can put food on the table for my family. Well, it's serious. 'Cause like we play high school. So like you're playing against you're 14, 15, 16 playing against 14, 15, 16, 17 year olds. Like that's high school. That's normal. You're playing in an age group. And then college, for the Americans, it's you're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 playing against guys your same age. So like, obviously as a freshman, you're playing up against 22 year olds, 21, 22 year olds, but you're also, there's that limit, you know, like, everywhere else in the world, you're not at your peak at 22 years old, and nobody is. Like, it's just physiologically, like, you're not at your peak. You're not as strong and fast or as you can be. You're not as smart or knowledgeable of the game as you can be. So when you, like, that's the critique of the American system is that, okay, you're 18 years old abroad, or you're 18 year old in Europe, you're playing up against 25, 26, 27 year olds, 30 year olds, and you're learning from professionals. So for us, it's like, okay, getting that mentality. And like, obviously, like it's not like a lack of motivation for us either. Cause like the competitiveness in college is huge, and playing for a team and playing for a university is a very, like, it's an honor, and people play with those, with their like club, with their team on their cap and team on their suit, and they're fired up and ready to go, and they're putting everything they have on the line. And that's wonderful and beautiful and everything like that sport should be. But there's also like a level beyond that. So getting that experience and being able to play against people who do this as a living is so like, well, I'm doing it as a living too. It's like, water polo, be like doing water polo for a living, and doing like having that pressure, that real life pressure on you is indispensable, honestly.
And for example, in Germany, we have also very often the discussion about the gap between maybe the first team and the second team, or the national team and the underage or under 90 whatever team. Do you think this is also a problem for the U.S., or is it not a problem because the players are coming to Europe, and then in this case we try, or the U.S. system tries to close the gap?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the hope, is to be able to close that gap. I mean, if you look at the teams that we've had in the past, like the 2016 team, you have a couple guys at the top, and then we have a large gap in age. So a lot of the guys were still in college. I was 1 year out of college, and a lot of guys were still finishing college like in 2016. And then 2020, we have a bunch of people retire. And then recently for Tokyo, we still had a lot of guys that were still in college that went back to college. And it's a difference. So it's like getting out there and being able to play. The COVID year was huge for us, because the NCAA allowed everyone to go abroad and play without to their eligibility, which is super important, because we had 17 guys playing abroad. And that was like the most we've ever had, which was huge for us.
Yeah. It's not really the easiest challenge to then for the coach to say, okay, I have more or less all of my team are playing somewhere across Europe. It's not really too easy to say, okay, I would like to see these games, but maybe in the meantime, we have a little bit more options and possibilities to see these in live streams or whatever platforms. Yeah. So in this case, maybe it's somehow easier for the coach to see you playing in Europe.
He's got a long list of contacts, so he knew to talk to. But I mean, a lot of us were in Greece too, which made it really easy for some trainings, because we trained with Greece a bunch before the Olympics, and it was like, I drove to practice. I had guys come in, like stay with me in my apartment, and then we drove to training. It worked out pretty well, honestly.
It sounds easy, at least. Yeah.
it ended up being a lot easier than we thought it was going to be.
In this case, it could also be a benefit then when you have people located there, yeah, saying, okay, I would like to invite you to my apartment, come along, yeah. And that's it.
Stay with me, let's go.
Exactly. At least it sounds like a little bit of fun also, yeah? It's not only hard work, but it's also fun to see all the guys then somewhere here in Europe again. When you think about that, you're also playing in different European countries. I'm sure that there are so many differences between Hungary, Serbia, France, Greece, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So what do you think are really the main differences between the countries? Or are you able to say, okay, maybe there are differences, and I would like to highlight some of these
differences? For sure there's differences. And
I'm sure.
It comes down to, like, it's very specific details. It's how they play defense in this way, how they move this way. Like, I'm just trying to remember something off the top of my head, but it's like the different, like the Greeks are all very well, like they're really well positioned, and they're very, like they're getting the most out of, they're getting the most out of their bodies and everything. They're moving well, they're shooting well, they're doing all this kind of stuff, but they are a lot more deadly just around the head. So like shooting wise, because like if you're faking with them, a lot of the guys on the Greek team aren't super tall, aren't super large, besides like Agropoulos and Skoumbakis and like some of their bigger guys. Like they have bigger guys, but a lot of their best shooters aren't 2 meters tall, like a Vamos or a Varga, you know? So you see with the Greeks that they have really good technique in getting around the shot block. And then you see like with the Serbians, they get up higher and they try and shoot over and shoot through you kind of thing. So it's like those are some differences that I see with that kind of stuff. It's emphasis on there's specific emphases on offense and defense that each coach and each like country kind of focuses on, you know. It's when I was at Apollon, the coach there was making sure that everything was like oriented toward the goalie, because he was a goalie, so all the shot blocks were making everything easier for the goalie, which was a different perspective than I'm used to, because I haven't had a lot of coaches that were goalies, you know. But it's those kind of differences that come with like individuals and that kind of stuff. So it's sometimes differences within coaches and differences between like coaching trees as well. So you have a lot of coaches that are like this coach, like they've all come from some local national coach that like has kind of taught and taken and has like his tactics have kind of gone down the line. Obviously have adjusted, and some of them adjusted with other coaches and everything, but their coaching tree kind of stays nationally as well.
Yeah. But it sounds like, so when you say, okay, there are so many specific differences between the countries, yeah, so between Greece and Hungary and Serbia, maybe, for example, then it's absolutely maybe the logic result for yourself to say, okay, I'm able to benefit from all these specific things and make all put my puzzle together. Yeah.
Exactly.
To put also my piece of puzzles here together and say, okay, I would use it, this from Serbia and this from Greece. And this makes you the, let's say complete player you maybe are at the moment. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you complete your puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, always, that's one of the things, is it's not a complete puzzle ever, you know. It's you're always adding to it and seeing what the picture is.
It's like you're building a house. You are not completely done somewhere in the future. No. There's every time something to do. When you attend also these international tournaments like Olympic Games, or you already mentioned the Olympic Games, or World Championship, Champions League, and so on and so forth, are you still nervous before these kind of games or tournaments, saying, okay, I attend maybe the Olympic Games, already one time. Now I'm going to Tokyo then the next time maybe, and there I'm maybe not at least so nervous again. Are you still nervous before these kind of big tournaments coming up?
Oh yeah, all the time. Like, no, it's a natural body reaction, and that's something that I've worked with. We've had a mental skills coach, a part of our staff, Brian Alexander, who is a former player. He missed out on the 2012 and I think 2008 Olympics too. He was like one of the last guys cut. But he was a psych major, came into like a sports psychology kind of focus. I think I'm pretty sure he has his master's and all this kind of stuff. And he's very smart, but he's also it breaks everything down in a very good way. And one of the things that we've talked about, and one of the things that I've actually tried to tell younger players as well, is the differences between nervousness and excitement. Mm-hmm. It's not that different. And it's something that you can do, something that I can do, something that everyone can do you can trick your brain a little bit. Say, am I nervous or am I excited? Like, that's a question that I say to myself before almost every game. And it's, am I nervous or am I excited? It's like, there's going to be butterflies. There's going to be everything. But as soon as that whistle blows, that's right. And it's excitement. Really, that's that driver. Like, I'm ready to play. I want to play the game that I love, and I'm ready to go, like, express myself and play and have fun and compete.
Maybe this brings me to the next question. Are there any rituals before each of these games? Because when you say you already work together with the mental coach, also these kind of mental coach saying, okay, I give you some advice that you really calm down before a game, and saying, okay, I need some rituals which I have to perform before each of these games, maybe.
Oh yeah, no, I've got my rituals. I've got my like pregame stuff. I've got my postgame rituals. I've got everything. So like, one of the things is like, when I get excited, like I really want to be a lot more calm. I want to be calm going into these games. Like, so I don't really like, I listen to like, we as a team, if we'll have like a Bluetooth speaker and we're listening to music on the car on the way up there, like, I'm listening with everybody, but also like I've talked about this before, but I listen to podcasts before games, just like comedy podcasts. Cause then I laugh. Like, I just, it's something that like keeps me calm. And like, I don't want that adrenaline spike until I get to the game, you know, like, mm-hmm. I'm really trying to conserve that, that energy, you know. And it's not like conserving energy of like, throughout the whole game, but conserve it until it's time to go, you know? And, it's something, again, that I've talked with Brian before. It's, there's a graph that we've talked about of, like excitement versus, what's the other axis? It's like, you want the excitement versus like performance. So you want to have that. Everybody has a different point to where their bell curve on this graph is. Do you want like how excited, like at what excitement level, at what, like, it was the other word that he used for it. I think he used like arousal for the word. So like, what level do you want that to be? Or what level does that have to be for your peak performance? Mm-hmm. So like, obviously you don't want to be a 10 on that. Cause if you're just amped up and ready to go, like, you're missing things and you're maybe taking too many shots, or maybe you're going too fast and you're not playing within the system, or playing within the sport, or playing within like the offense, you know. Maybe, but if you're too low on it, maybe you're being taken advantage of, maybe you're getting pushed around, and maybe you're not being able to like actually participate, you know. So you're trying to find that balance. And like, for some people it's a little bit higher, some people it's a little bit lower. Like, I'm a little bit more on the lower end for it. So like, I just need to get up to that spot and just find that zone, you know, be in the zone. And find that zone is like, for me, it's like assessing what part of that arousal scale that I'm on, or what excitement level that I'm on.
Yeah, yeah, but this sounds also that each of these persons or players would really work or to find or to analyze really these points, yeah, mm-hmm. Very specifically and very on a personal basis. Yeah, so oh, yeah. As you mentioned before, that it's really yeah for each of these players maybe then a different point somewhere in the diagram.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. It's never the same for between two people. Like, I mean, like every team that I've been on, you have different like guys who are warming up differently. You know, like everybody's yeah. found something that gets them to the game. It's this is more of a like the veterans on the team. There's all like they have their routines and they go through their routines and they find their rituals and everything and they get set in that kind of way. It's, so they've found their point to get to the game. You know. It's yeah. it's more yeah. for like younger players, like, hey, you can find you need to find this at a play. You need to find where that point is for yourself. But like everybody's had, like I've had multiple like on every team. There's the one guy that's like headphones in, locked in, talk to them. Like it's like, and then you have the one guy who's like cracking jokes and everything. You know, like it's different. Different people have different like, and yeah. you know. Who you can go to, who you don't go to, like leave them alone, let them do their thing. But I can like go around and like grab this guy, wrestle with this guy. And, you know, like it like
yeah.
bring everybody into the team. But, you know, it's like, but everybody has their thing.
At the end, in general, this makes also maybe then the success at the end, yeah, that you have all these kind of individuals in your team saying, okay, I need different characters, yeah, different persons saying, okay, I need this one make a good atmosphere in the rocker room, maybe, for example.
Oh yeah, yeah. And, no, it's that too, but like it's more the actions that you take that really kind of determine that kind of stuff, and it's like you can have different levels of excitement for. Like on every team, and it can blend completely fine, like in any kind of situation. It's just making sure that the actions of these guys that aren't being detrimental to everyone else.
Yeah. I just want to come back again a little bit more about these big tournaments. Yeah. Let's say it that way.